Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helberg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein, still of the Inland Ocean Coalition.
And how is everyone today?
Hopefully well. And since you just came back from skiing, Vicki, today's guest is a perfect match. He's just come back from a major dog sled race in Bethel, Alaska. After a decade with the Alaska Daily News and Alaska Public Media, reporter Nat Hurst launched the Northern Journal in 2022. It's a newsletter that focuses on public lands and waters, also energy production, mining, logging, fisheries, and politics, of course. Its stories have been picked up pretty much by every media outlet in the state. And what struck me on a recent reporting trip up there is how much goes on in Alaska that could impact the nation and the world, including the opening up of America's fourth blue water coast on the Arctic Ocean, and how little of that information filters down to the lower 48. So, Nat, lots to talk about. But first, give us some of your background. I know you weren't raised in Alaska, so when and how did you arrive and become one of the state's leading investigative reporters?
You want to go the cheerful, positive, happy dog mushing route, which was where I was living for the past 96 hours, or the grim conflict, civil unrest direction of everything that has happened over the past couple months.
And it's let's like, start out with happy stuff. Let's start
years.
Out with
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Start out with you.
You and what inspired you?
I grew up in coastal Maine, and I was not like raised on a boat or anything, but close enough to the coast that the water was definitely like a part of my upbringing. And then originally got into journalism. I competed as a cross-country ski racer in college and actually started covering that sport when I finished up. And then went to grad school in New York City and was working there for a little while and just felt it was an interesting place to work, but just wasn't for me. And so ended up taking a job working at the Anchorage Daily News, covering sort of local politics. And then the paper went bankrupt and it was purchased by some more conservative Fairbanks originating business owners. And so I stuck it out for a little while, but got a little burned out, went to work at the Public Radio Network and also maximized my time there and was trying to figure out what to do next, and had a sort of some part-time options that were paying me well enough to start Northern Journal as a newsletter and news website. And it's worked out that there's just kind of popular grassroots support. People sign up in $100 increments as voluntary subscribers, and then I've been able to find some grant funders to support like specific projects. So I just operate half out of my home and half out of a shared office and try to work enough to pay the bills, but also still try to really get out to be on the land and on the water in Alaska. I help some friends at a small commercial fishing operation for a couple weeks every summer. I try to paddle and camp and also really try to find ways to like get out to the different regions of Alaska through work and do partnerships with some of the local media organizations. Like this past weekend covering the sled dog race is a volunteer gig, but afforded me the chance to get out to some villages along the Kuskokwim River and just get off the beaten path.
You're kind of indicative of a trend in the media industry. Northern Journal's obviously succeeding at the level that all the other media in the state seem to be picking up on your stories.
The kind of technology that has developed in the past like decade that has really facilitated folks dipping out from some of the like legacy traditional outlets, and certainly has made that easy for me. People are always asking me if I'm spending a whole lot of time doing business and logistical managerial things, and I'm like, not really. But I do also really, I don't necessarily think that it's a totally new concept, and I find inspiration in the IF Stone, you know, kind of pamphleteer style of journalism going way back decades. And there's always been opportunities to be outside that more mainstream corporate net, but we'd be in a really bad place without the Anchorage Daily News, just as I feel like there's important work for me to be doing outside that.
So why do you feel like your investigative work is so impactful? And then how do you choose the stories that resonate most with both local and national audiences?
If I'm being like dead honest, the real reason that my stories get picked up by all these outlets across the state is that they're available for free. And I am not going to cast judgment on my own work and say it's always 10 out of 10, but it's always at least 5 out of 10, which, you know, like checks the box for most places. As far as like the story selection and what I do, my real guiding principle as Northern Journal has been, I'm only going to do stories that aren't otherwise going to be done unless I do them, one. And then two, my stories are purely guided by my own value judgments about what is interesting. And I really have prioritized not doing stories for national audiences. Sometimes there are stories where there, again, is like an overlap between a story that's of like statewide interest to Alaskans and a story that's of like national interest to people who live outside of Alaskans. But oftentimes, in my experience working with national publications, my interests and values as like an Alaskan, I felt like they would often get pulled in a direction by national editors trying to cast things and categorize things and even just explain.
So that leads me into a quick question about, do you feel like with your reporting that you have or are holding policymakers or industries accountable for your stories?
I definitely would describe my journalism as like accountability journalism, like writ large. On an individual day, writing a story about dog mushing doesn't necessarily do that, but I feel like that is a essential function of the line of work that I do. That work on a given day for a given story could apply to state policymakers, local policymakers, or federal policymakers, for whom some of their work obviously like involves like management of Alaska lands, resources, et cetera.
Two things. One is your stories also get picked up because you get around the state. And every time I go to Alaska, I'm reminded it's like covering all of Western Europe. If Western Europe basically didn't have a road system, you're getting around by plane, by boat. It's a difficult environment to cover. You have the contacts. And also you are covering state issues that national story might be the natural gas pipeline that the state wants to build across the state. You cover the fact that with all the production of oil and natural gas in the state, tell us briefly, the cities aren't going to get natural gas the way things are going in the state.
This is a sort of an interesting ongoing story that I've been covering for the past 2 years, basically since Northern Journal started. And generally speaking, interesting sort of fact about Alaska is that like our utilities here, all of the major urban electric utilities are cooperatively owned. So basically urban Alaska, they have depended for decades since the 1960s or so on locally produced natural gas from the Cook Inlet Basin outside of Anchorage in the Kenai Peninsula to produce power. That basin is aging. It's like we've poked a lot of holes in it. We've taken a lot of gas out. It's at a certain point for decades, we were actually exporting natural gas over to Japan. But now we're tight on supplies and we have policymakers who are extremely averse to importing fossil fuels from outside of the state in the form of liquefied natural gas, because it would be like if you went to Nebraska and floated the idea of importing corn. And so that has put us into a pretty delicate situation where we are really stressing the ability of our oil and natural gas industry to produce enough gas from this basin to meet the instantaneous needs and the short to medium term needs of our electrical grid and also of our like home heating systems, which largely in the Anchorage area and on the Kenai and out in the Matsu, like Sarah Palin land, that all runs on natural gas. And basically, the obvious solution is to build a liquefied natural gas imports terminal where we would import small amounts of natural gas. But we've got all these other kind of political considerations that are making that decision by the utilities much more charged than it would be in a more rational place. And so we are facing increasingly the risk that we might end up into a situation where power would have to be rationed and we'd go through a rolling blackout.
So that's a great example of a story really important to Alaskans that's not going to gain a lot of interest in the lower 48. I don't think people realize the scale at which resources are being put up on the block, impacting both the generation of minerals and fossil fuels, but also impacting Alaska in terms of heating three times as fast as the rest of the country. So you've got, I guess, one question. The scale of mining and drilling is not perceived in leasing. That's all going to change. 2 days in office, President Trump said, we're going to open up Alaska. It's resources for the nation. And your governor said, go. What do you see is really happening? What's your projections?
There was a lot of hyperbole that was thrown out there on that first day of the Trump administration. As much as Trump might like to be, and our congressional delegation might like to be throwing kind of hyperbole around about what they want to do and what they want to accomplish and what they're going to unlock, we also have a incredibly motivated, incredibly dedicated community of like NGOs and civil society groups here in Alaska that are ready to put a stop or get an injunction against any overzealous and illegal efforts by the federal government to do things that are not actually authorized by Congress. And you look across the board, it's already being litigated by like resource groups over what the Biden administration did, and that's all locked up. And then like you reach back even further, it's like the litigation probably actually started during the previous Trump administration. And so none of this stuff actually happens fast at all. But really what's actually more important, oil companies don't actually want to drill because they know that they're going to get sued and it makes no sense to invest because you have no certainty about your ability to build anything. The real action is in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, which is an area that has been going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth over, it's called integrated activity plans, basically management plans for petroleum development, environmental protection. And it's been like a tug of war going back to the Clinton administration. Like literally, it's like Clinton did one thing, then Bush did one thing, then Obama did one thing, then Trump did one thing, then Biden did one thing, and now Trump wants to go back and do something else. And these are incredibly detailed, extensive processes and systems that we have the National Environmental Policy Act. You can't just run trucks over the tundra and get put up drilling rigs in the course of days or months. It's like this stuff really is like year measured in years and decades. And you also have investors that look at these projects, not even in years, but in decades. There are a lot of big dynamics that are going to make it hard for the Trump administration to execute all of these pieces of their vision. Not to say that it's not going to cause a lot of anxiety and stress and that they aren't going to have incremental wins and maybe even some big wins. But I just have lived here for going on 12 years now. And we still don't have a pebble mine. We still have no drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We still don't have an Ambler Road. We don't have large-scale logging in the Tongass. Like,
if you don't have the guarantees on your investment, everything, the infrastructure, moving, transportation, so expensive there. And in the meantime, the Arctic Ocean is becoming a blue water coast. It was 89 degrees in August at Prudhoe Bay, which is a functioning oil production site.
The blue water that is growing and what that navigation might look like, and also some of the new shipping routes in the maritime activity. So that's a really interesting topic to touch on. Give us some insight.
One thing I've discovered is this is one of those areas where you have this kind of state audience versus national audience tension, and that national media and a national audience, like folks are much more attuned to a sort of civil discourse around climate change, global warming, what do we do about it? They see Alaska as an environment and a place that is like a cryosphere with glaciers and ice and things like that, and a place that's like really deeply affected by warming. I tried to write those stories when I for an Alaska audience, and they don't resonate. The stories in Alaska that resonate are like what is going to happen to the berries that I pick or the caribou that I hunt, or what is going to happen to the homes on the tundra if the permafrost is thawing? Or I wrote a story about the Red Dog mine, which is one of the biggest operating mines in Alaska, the largest zinc mine in the world. And all of a sudden, they were basically not able to discharge their wastewater because they were not going to hit the discharge criteria that was required for like suspended particles, because there were all these suspended particles flowing into the creek that goes through the mining area because the permafrost was thawing. So through no fault of their own, they had to shut down $15 or $20 million on a reverse osmosis treatment plant. So that's really the lens through which I've tried to do these stories. I don't do sort of opinion stuff, and I feel like there's enough going on the ground as far as like developments and stories unfolding of climate change impacts that like informing people about those is where I can provide more value than if I am opining about the need to do anything in particular in response.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
Tell us a story that maybe you haven't touched on that is significant for Alaskans that have been picked up nationally that really has a broader climate national interest.
There was a major movement associated with the opening of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where you had advocacy groups pressuring like big banks and insurers and other financial industry organizations to not underwrite projects in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, except they actually made it broader and said they were pressuring for no underwriting of projects anywhere in the Arctic, which I actually think in a way that was an unintended consequence and kind of a backfiring of the efforts by Alaska policymakers to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, because there is no near or even medium term oil to be drained from the Arctic Refuge, but there is actually quite a lot of oil to be drained out of the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, which also happens to be in the Arctic. And so if you have banks and insurers and other financial services organizations saying we're not supporting development anywhere in the Arctic, all of a sudden, not only did you lose this Arctic refuge area that was off the table anyway, you just made it a lot harder for companies to raise money to do big projects anywhere in Alaska, including these bigger project, really big projects in historically less litigated areas of Alaska within the National Petroleum Reserve. There's this big Australian company, Santos, that's developing a project that's almost equal in size to Willow called the Pika Project. And they very publicly had huge problems raising the billions of dollars they needed to actually make that project happen. And they said there were sources that told me that was largely because of this kind of categorical like ban and objection to investment in oil in the Arctic. And that's definitely a story that is actually not just of national importance, but also global significance as we get into these questions of, okay, if we still have an economy that runs largely on fossil fuels, like where is it going to come from? And Alaska policymakers often argue that we have high environmental standards here and it should come from Alaska as opposed to Russia or the Middle East. But you're starting to see some pushback to that based on environmental, not so much like.
So we'll be looking for a new story from you on that topic.
Not anytime soon. That's just one I've done in the past. But I've got plenty of other things keeping me occupied right now, actually, in the fisheries realm.
It's like a kid in a candy shop. There are so many issues that are not being covered in Alaska. Do you cover the sort of U.S. strategic role in the Arctic as there's more competition with China and Russia, and also indigenous communities are seeing huge changes?
I actually feel like that is a enormously important developing story in Alaska. And that's another kind of case where I actually think that like the Alaska audience has been short shrifted on that kind of coverage actually compared to the national audience, because the agencies that really are involved in management of the Bering Strait, Bering Sea, Arctic Ocean, these are really like big federal agencies, Department of Defense, like the military, the Coast Guard, and they are agencies that have heavier presences and particularly like more of a media presence on the East Coast. And so what is actually reporters flying up to Alaska and going out on these military vessels or on these military expeditions in the Bering Sea or in the interior and reporting back this romanticized dispatch about the high seas or the kind of Arctic commando exercises getting ready to combat the Russian army. But those opportunities actually almost never are offered to reporters who actually live here. And it actually drives me crazy. And it's an area where I have a real interest in kind of investing some more time and energy to better understand. I do think that some of these developments with like China and Russia doing more shipments of like oil and potentially cargo through
the Bering Strait. Just thinking about the international shipping and the security and the potential for oil spills and response. It's a big, big topic.
The Russians are now refusing to do joint oil spill response exercises with the U.S. Coast Guard. And the local stories, Nome has a deep water port in the making. If it gets funding, the Coast Guard's going to place its icebreaker down in Juneau. So is it a Department of Defense port in Nome? What's going on? And of course, the people living in the Bering Strait who are seeing the threat of Russian disaster. And you're right. I've not seen any stories for the Alaskan audience about what the Arctic Ocean is going to impact the state the way you do stories on mines and communities.
There's only so much bandwidth, but we have enormous geostrategic and geopolitical importance here in Alaska and like huge assets already here, like our enormous military base in Anchorage. There's been an enormous buildup in Fairbanks. If the U.S. gets into any kind of conflict with China or over Taiwan, it's like all of our jets here in Anchorage are basically being taken by a general in Hawaii and repositioned to either backfill jets from Hawaii or head straight over to Asia. And because of the importance of those aircraft, like my understanding and reporting, like really indicates that like our Alaska military assets here and our bases are going to be targets by China in the event of a conflict. Like we're probably going to have missiles landing on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson on the outskirts of Anchorage.
You mentioned something about fisheries, and I read your story about the Prince William Sound trawl bycatch. Was that what you were referring to?
No, that's...
Oh, okay. I mean, that's another one that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like fisheries is like its own glacier-sized topic here in Alaska, right? You think fisheries in Alaska and you might think salmon, or you might think deadliest catch, or you might think like these enormous political battles that we've been having over bycatch in the trawl industry, like in the Bering Sea and in the Gulf of Alaska. And it's like there are dozens of fisheries that are existentially important and enormously economically important to people and groups and businesses and tribes and policymakers all across the waters surrounding and winding their way through our state. And you have overlapping management regimes between the state and federal governments. And it's just sort of endless stories. And it's also endlessly complicated and complex, where all of these kind of management regimes come with insane jargon, impenetrable levels of bureaucracy, both for the fishermen and the people seeking to participate in the process, but also with like journalists and writers who are like trying to explain it for the general public. And so I've got a number of projects like tackling some of that stuff, and you know, some other stuff I've been developing.
And then you get marine heat waves and climate change on top of that, and what happens with the fisheries and Western Alaskan salmon moving up into the Arctic Ocean.
You have your hands full. To wrap up, I really want to know, what gives you hope?
I am inspired by Alaskans' willingness and readiness to support what I'm doing and my efforts to give them kind of nonpartisan, unbiased, basic information about the systems that control their lives and the way they live their lives and the way that they access publicly owned lands and waters, or lands that are not publicly owned that have been decided politically that they are going to be in another status. And I am consistently surprised and grateful for the way in which, like, Alaskans, since I have started this business in the past couple of years, like, have shown over and over again with their credit cards that they really value in-depth, substantive, non-agenda driven journalism. And I piss people off with my stories on the regular, but piss off people on the left, and I piss off people on the right, and I piss off people who are my neighbors, and I piss off people in sort of far-flung areas. And
you seem like such a nice guy to make so many people angry.
It's a quote, an old friend who, John Hoagland, who was killed in Central America, photographer, and one night we're talking, he says, "I don't believe in objective journalism. Everyone has a point of view. I just say, if you do something right, I'll take your picture. If you do something wrong, I'll take your picture also." Yeah. And you're taking a great picture of what Alaska, so say a non-Alaskan wants to get a better sense of what are the stories for Alaskans. How do they find out more about the Northern Journal?
Yeah, you just head to northernjournal.com. All the stories are free. And we are always interested in possible partnerships, and anyone who wants to sign up and become a voluntary member for $100 or talk about grant funding, like, that's great too. But I've really felt like making the info, like, I want to reach as broad an audience as I can. And so keeping it free and making it optional, like, if it didn't work for me, I'd be doing something else. But right now, people have been generous to support it, and generous enough to support it even when it's not necessary. So yeah, it's all right there, northernjournal.com. It's got all the back issues and how to sign up and all that. So yeah, appreciate you guys having me on. It's been a fun conversation.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. Thank you, Nat Hertz, founder of the Northern Journal, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Hopefully all boats will be lifted.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, Kelly Bates, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Dear, dear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky! There you are, good boy, Sparky!